Well, he starts to work, and indeed a glorious palace was coming to birth here. And every time Indra came and looked over the site, he thought, oh, a little more of this there and a little more of that here. And this thing kept going and going. So Vishvakarman said, my God, this is going to go on. And we're both immortal, so there's no end to it. And becoming extremely unhappy about this, he went to the higher up. Now the higher up, higher than Indra, who's simply king of the gods, was Brahma, who represents the creative force. He sits on a lotus, and this lotus grows from the navel of Vishnu, who is sleeping on a great serpent whose name is Endless, and that serpent is on the immortal waters. So we have this lovely picture of the immortal sea, the serpent floating on it as a kind of seven-headed couch, Vishnu sleeping on the serpent, all of them representing the same thing, namely the immortal waters. His dream sends forth this world lotus, which is us. Sitting on that is this, you know, executive secretary who brings forth the world, named Brahma. So, Vishvakarman comes to Brahma and he says, I am in trouble. And he describes the situation. And Brahma says, very well, you go back to work, I'll see the big boy downstairs. So, he went to the edge of the cosmic ocean, kneeling by the waters, great form floating out there, dreaming the dream of the universe, and he issued his prayer, and the great sleeping being simply made a gesture indicating, I got it. Next morning, Indra has come to see his palace, and the porter comes running into him and says, there's a beautiful young Brahmin boy outside, and the children are all around him, and he is an auspicious sign. Invite him in, and this will be a wonderful thing for the palace. Well, inviting a Brahmin in, Brahmins are greater than the gods, is a grand thing. So Indra invites the Brahmin boy in, and after giving him hospitality, says, now what has brought you here? The boy speaks, and his voice is like thunder rumbling on the distant horizon, and he says, I've heard that you are building the greatest palace, a palace such as no Indra ever built before you. I've come, I've seen, it is so. No Indra ever built such a palace before you. Indra sitting there. Little pipsqueak. Indra's before me? What are you talking about? There's something rather frightening about it all. And the boy says, I have seen Indras and Indras and Indras. Every time Brahma opens his eye, a world comes into being, governed by an Indra. When he closes it, the world goes. Opens, another world. Closes, another world. Presently, the lotus goes, that Brahma goes, another lotus, eyes, Indras, Brahmas. From beginning to end, endlessly in all directions. And then said the boy, consider the galaxies of Brahmas. To the infinitudes of infinity. Each with its Vishnu, each with its Brahmas, each with its Indras. There may be sages in your court who would tell you they could count the sands of the sea. There are none who would dare to count those Brahmas, let alone Indras. While he's talking, there appears, coming in the palace floor, a parade of ants. About 4 yards wide, in perfect ranks, parading across the floor. And the boy sees them, he laughs. And Indra's whiskers go out. What? This. Don't ask, said the boy, unless you want to be hurt. Well, says Indra, teach. The basic thought in the Orient is, for higher teaching, you must ask questions. The teacher answers the questions. Since wisdom is of such magnitude, there's nothing to say. What we have to do is simply talk to your point. So Indra says, teach me about these ants. The boy says, former Indra's all. Through eons of reincarnation, they have worked their way up through the scales of life, 84 billion incarnations or so, and they get to the status of Indra. Then they slay the dragon. And then they say, how great am I? And I comes in, and I goes down, and we start again. And while he's talking, there comes into the palace an old yogi, crotchety old fellow, with an umbrella of banana leaves, something like the picture of Robinson Crusoe we've all seen. And he's wearing the leopard skin loincloth of a yogi, and on his chest is a curious circle of hair, and all the hair in the center is gone. So this old fellow comes in, and the boy says, who are you? What's your name? Where do you live? What's the name of your wife and family? Why do you have that umbrella? And what's the meaning of that curious design of hair on your chest? Well, says the old fellow, Harry is my name. I don't have a house. Life's short. This umbrella, that's plenty for me. Keeps the sun off my head. I'm not married. I don't have children. Why have children? Why produce things for this fleeting world? Nothing lasts. And you know, about these hairs, it's curious. And perhaps there's a lesson to be learned from them. Every time an Indra dies, one hair drops out. They're half gone now. Pretty soon they'll all be gone. Life's short. Why build a house? Well, at that, these two disappear. They are, of course, the two great deities. Vishnu, the dreamer, sent a hair down to become this incarnation of the boy. And Shiva, the great yogi, sent a manifestation to appear as the yogi. Well, the stunned Indra, who represents man in authority, man in dignity, man of the world, is terribly biffed. And he thinks, I'm going to quit. I'm going to leave it all. I'm going to become a yogi. I'm going into the forest and I'm going to meditate and I'm going to come in touch with the transcendent bliss of eternity and let this whole thing drop off. Now, this is the big collision in the Orient between the idea of dharma, the idea of social duty, the idea of those three ends that I've already mentioned, the ends of virtue, of pleasure and success. Indra had succeeded in all of these. And the fourth end, which is dropping it all, throwing it off. Now, this is not individuation in Jung's terms at all. It is canceling even ego. It is canceling desire for pleasure. It is canceling desire for success. It is canceling virtue. It is what is called moksha. Release, dropping it. Well, when Indra's beautiful queen, Indrani, learns that her spouse, she in her prime divinity, you might say, is about to go off to the forest, she turns to the palace priest named Brihaspati, the lord of divine power, and says, this is something. A yogi comes into the palace. He sees the yogi. He's now got the idea he's going out and become a yogi. He's going to leave the whole thing. Here we're going to be. Well said, Brihaspati, come with me, dear. He takes her by the hand, sits before Indra, and he gives him a little priestly sermon. The sermon is, cosmos is a manifestation of the eternal being. It comes like a flower, it goes like a flower, coming, going, coming, going. We, in our being, participate in that. We think of ourselves as egos, but actually we are in participation with this cosmic process. You, as the Lord of all creatures, are in a particularly fine position to make manifest the glory of the cosmos, the egolessness of all beings, to realize in the life of love, to realize in the life of warcraft and conquest, to realize in the life of virtue, the process, and to make it manifest. There are those who have to go to the forest and cast off the world in order to find eternity. There are those, on the other hand, who living in the world can be, as it were, yogis within, what in the Orient is called the mystic garment within and the garment of the law without. This is the high ideal, O Indra, and this is for you. Now, in this story, I think all of the play of the Oriental possibilities are indicated. You can see the force of the reincarnation idea, the force of the egolessness idea, the force of the vast development of cosmic eons in which the individual plays simply as a functioning entity. You can see also that two ways are indicated, the way of quitting and the way of coming back. Now, in the last 15 minutes, I want to speak about the various ways of quitting and coming back, which I think will indicate something about the Oriental ideas of the individual. The first idea is that this reincarnating monad, this reincarnating principle, is in essence absolutely pure. It is like a pure bubble. It has no quality. It has no individuality. It has no character. But it is contaminated by karmic matter, by the stuff of the world. And the whole world, in fact, is nothing but a seething mass of these monads trapped in the substance of the world. There are two principles here. This is a strict dualism. This is the point of view of the Jains, Jainism. There is a strict dualism. There is the pure self, and there is that self in play in the world. All action contaminates that self, even what we call pure action. There are said to be six colors that pour into the soul, into this monad, through action. The grossest, roughest color activity yields the color black to the soul. Next comes the color dark blue. Then comes the color of smoke. Then comes the color of fire. Then yellow color. And then white. The soul itself is translucent. It isn't even white. Now these colors weigh the soul down, and souls that are black are born in the lower regions of the cosmic body. Souls that are light are born further up, and souls that are white are born up in the brain. This would be heaven. So you have this cosmic being with the different stages of development indicated in various parts of its body. In order to get above that and rise to a place that's called slightly tilted, it's an enormous umbrella up above this being, to go up there as a pure bubble, you have to perform certain very strict yogic exercises. And this yoga of the Jains is based on the idea that you must stop acting, stop moving, stop eating, stop thinking. Stop feeling. Finally, stop breathing. But it's no good dying unless you have quelled absolutely all interest in life. If there is one little spark of, oh, wouldn't it be nice, left in you, you'll be back. Furthermore, as you proceed down the line, it's a fierce yoga, as you proceed down the line, you build up more pressure for coming back, so that in the last stages of this furious affair, the slightest little thing can dislodge you and you come right back. Well, you can understand that this is a rigorous, fierce affair. And by gradations, one takes vows. One vows not to eat anything that has life in it. That's to say, even an apple that has been picked from a tree. You eat only dead things. You take vows not to walk more than 4 or 5 steps a day, because in walking you hurt things. You step on insects. Also, you apply pressure to the molecules of the earth. You can see in Bombay to this day, people walking with little gauze over their mouths. These are the Jain monks and nuns. And that is there not only so that you shouldn't breathe in an insect, but also so that when you breathe, you shouldn't hurt the air. And you shouldn't hurt the tissues of your throat. These are all very tender things. Well, if life is that delicate, let it go, you know? Get out. This doctrine, well, there are two kinds of monks here. The strict monks are called those clothed in space, Digambara. They say absolutely naked monks. They take off all their clothes, they pull out all their hair, they reject everything having to do with a reference to society. And you can see the images of these great, stark, naked figures standing perfectly still in the posture known as Kayotsarga, which is dismissing the body. Let it go. The other variety of monk is much less strict. This is known as Shvetambara, dressed in white. They wear white garments, and you can see them in the cities with these protections. There's a very funny story connected with this order. You know, pious people are strange everywhere. In this particular case, two chaps come along through the street of Bombay with a cot full of bed bugs. And they call, "Who will feed the bugs? Who will feed the bugs?" And some lady in the window tosses out a coin. That means she will feed the bugs. So one of the chaps lies down in the bed for a rupee, and the bugs have their dinner, and she has gained credit for assisting this inferior type of life to have its little enjoyment and move on. You know, it'll be up in about 84,000 more incarnations, perhaps going around with a cot saying, "Who will feed the bugs?" Well, now, the great teacher of this doctrine, Mahavira, was a contemporary of the Buddha. And the Buddha despised the doctrine. He said that this idea of a purely physical detachment from the world is altogether wrong in its thinking. The proper problem is psychological. This is a great moment in the world. 500 BC, a strictly psychological approach to the problem. This was a moment of immense importance. It does not matter whether you eat meat. It does not matter whether you kill things as you walk around. What matters is your psychological attitude. Do you act with desire for the fruits of action, or with fear, or do you act simply because it is your duty to act? This is known in Hinduism as karma yoga. Acting without desire or fear, but simply in terms of the process. Now with the Buddha, he would not have you act in the world at first. His doctrine was first interpreted as a monastic doctrine, as a doctrine of quitting the world, just as the Jains quit the world. And the first communities of Buddhists did quit the world. But we find in Buddhism a very strong movement of living in the world without desire or fear, but simply, as it were, in action. The fundamental notion is that once you have abandoned the world of desire and the world of fear, you undergo a psychological shift. Your ego attitude is dropped, and you act simply as the world acts, in what is called spontaneity. You become, as it were, a tree. You become a plant. You live right out of yourself. One can hear in this word of Christ about, consider the lilies of the field. They labor not, neither do they spin. They are not anxious. This idea swept the whole Orient, and it matched notions that were already present in China and Japan. In China, the idea of Lao Tzu, of Wu Wei, non-effort, action without striving, letting it roll, letting your life just roll. This idea is the basic Buddha idea, and it broke the grip of this literal yoga of killing yourself. And when you have detached yourself like this, you are, as it were, just, well, one term that's used is a burnt string. When a string has been burnt, lying on the ground, it looks like a string still, but if you go, it isn't there. And so it is with a person who has quenched his commitment to ego and has pulled back. He is, as it were, in the center, and life moves through him just in a rolling process. This is the basic ideal, I would say, for the individual living in the world, whether it's in Hinduism, in Buddhism, in Taoism, or in the world of Japan. Now I will conclude by making a very brief distinction. This is drawing lines a little too sharply, but in a brief discussion, it's all possible. In India, there is a mood of world renunciation. Even though we can say that living in the world we are without ego, there is nevertheless a pathos of world renunciation in India. The Indian, as it were, wishes to identify himself with an eternal principle which remains still. And when you read the first aphorism of Indian yoga in the Yoga Sutras, it says, yoga is the intentional stopping of the spontaneous activity of the mind, making it stop, making it stand still, so that there's no ripple of life, and so that the glorious image of perfection shines through imperfection. Whereas in China and Japan, the attitude is rather roll with the world. The saying there is, let the thoughts come, let them move. The geese fly over the pond. Their image is reflected in the pond. The pond made no effort to grab the image. It made no effort to hold them. It comes, it goes. Let it pass that way. In the Taoism of China, you have an attitude of finding the Tao by leaving society, going into the forest, going onto the mountains, and participating in nature. Union with the Tao of nature. In the world of Confucius, you have the idea of finding the Tao in society through a sincere enactment of traditional decorum in which a sentiment of fellow feeling is communicated and participated in. And it's through this that the human Tao is experienced, but always according to the rules of the Chinese family system, relationship of father to son, wife to husband, older brother to younger brother, and so forth. In Japan, something I think that might be called the extreme of the union of release and world experience in one moment is experienced. Here you have the idea of freedom within the very social pattern in which you live. The idea of doing the job that you have to do, and at the same time having a spontaneity that amounts to freedom, to choice, to saying yay. And I want to give one story in conclusion to illustrate this Japanese approach. The idea of Zen in Japan, the idea of meditation in Zen is a word from the Chinese jhan, which comes from the Sanskrit jhana, which means contemplation. You contemplate the divinity, the power, the wonder of the world in all things, and in yourself and in your own action. This idea in Japan in the 12th century was taken up by the knights, the samurai, the priestly warriors. And all of the arts of combat and war were associated with this Zen, so that nothing is happening. It is simply the process that is taking place through this strictly controlled legal activity of the warrior in his fencing techniques and so forth. Well, there's a story of a samurai whose overlord had been murdered, and he assumed the duty and task of avenging the murder in a vendetta. And he, after years, had finally got his man against a wall, and his great samurai sword was ready to take off his head. And this chap, who was now cornered like a rat, in fury and distraction and not knowing what to do, spit at the other man, spit in his face. And this noble warrior put his sword back in the sheath and walked away. Why? Because that man had made him angry. Thank you, Mason.
Listening to Individual in Oriental Mythology by Joseph Campbell in the series entitled Mythology and the Individual. This recording was authorized by the Joseph Campbell Foundation and produced by Electronic Educational Programs. Our theme music is by Acoustic Alchemy. For more information on the work of Joseph Campbell, please call the Foundation at 1-800-330-6984. Or you can contact us on the World Wide Web at jcf.org. I'm Maura Vaughn. Thank you for listening.